Andrew Cohen joins us this morning. He is the author of the new book, 2 Days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. Cohen is an award-winning journalist and former Washington correspondent who the New York Times has called one of Canada's most distinguished authors. Again, the new book is 2 Days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. We welcome Andrew Cohen to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here.
What brought you to the subject and wanting to look into these 2 days in June?
Well, I've been following Kennedy, in a sense, all my life. I'm one of that generation who remembers exactly where he was when the president was killed. Although I'm a Canadian, I ended up at the same school as JFK did in New England. I was later, I studied in the United States. I was later a Washington correspondent for the Globe and Mail of Toronto. So I have had an enduring interest in Kennedy. But as you know, Joe, the field is very full. There have been many, many books on JFK. And my hope was to find a new way to look at JFK, to find a way into the story without writing another chronicle of the Cuban Missile Crisis or another full-length biography. We have many of those. So I came across, interestingly, what I do call these 2 days in June, which I call JFK's lyrical journey to peace and freedom. It all turns on two speeches, on two issues, the biggest of his generation, on June 10th and June 11th, 1963. One is on nuclear arms, the other is on civil rights, and both lead to very big things.
The 2 days are June 10th and June 11th, 1963, and part of what you draw on for the book is hours of this newly uncovered documentary film that was shot in the White House on those 2 days. Give us a sense of that film and what it allowed you to do.
Well, the 2 days turn on, as I say, the two speeches. One, it was at American University on June the 10th, in which President Kennedy makes an appeal to Nikita Khrushchev to renew talks on bringing in a nuclear test ban. And he's successful in doing that. He does it by humanizing the Russians and making an appeal to Americans and asking them to see the Russians differently. The next day, on June the 11th, is the civil rights speech, and that flows in which JFK will do the same thing. He will humanize Negroes, as they're then called, black Americans, and ask Americans to think differently about them, and that will lead to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The film that I refer to was shot by Robert Drew. Robert Drew was what we would call, or what was called then, a cinema verite filmmaker. He had been a photographer at Life magazine, and he was experimenting in the early 1960s with a very direct form of documentary making, and that was simply handheld cameras, no tripods, no script, no narration, simply cameras following people around. He had done this in the 1960 election campaign when he had followed JFK around Wisconsin. When JFK was running for the nomination, he was up against Hubert Humphrey, and Robert Drew's cameras followed both Hubert Humphrey and John F. Kennedy around Wisconsin. It led to a film called Primary, which Robert Drew showed JFK in late 1960, after he had been elected but not yet taken office. And he asked JFK then, he said, "I'd like to film you in the White House during a crisis." And for the next 2.5 years, from the time JFK took office in January of 1961 till these events in June of 1963, Robert Drew and his team looked for a crisis. Now, there were many crises in the Kennedy presidency. We'll remember the Bay of Pigs, of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis. But every time there was a crisis, Pierre Salinger, who was JFK's press secretary, told Robert Drew, "You can't film a foreign policy crisis for reasons of national security." Then Robert Drew noticed in June of 63 that George Wallace, the governor of Alabama, who had been elected just the year before, who was one of the last segregationists, had promised to stand in the door of the University of Alabama and prevent the integration of the university, which had been petitioned by two black students, James Hood and Vivian Malone. And that was going to take place, Joe, on June the 11th, 1963. By order of the court, those two were going to be admitted that day. So it was an emerging crisis because Wallace said, I will not allow it to happen. The Kennedys say, you must allow it to happen. We have a court order. And Wallace has said, I'm not budging. And the Kennedys said, if you don't budge, we'll call the National Guard. And they were worried about another explosion in the South, which all that spring was exploding over civil rights. In Birmingham, where Dr. Martin Luther King had been thrown into jail, there were days and days, even weeks of footage of black protesters, mainly children, amid the fire hoses and the German Shepherd. So the Robert Drew sees this happening, dispatches film crews down south with Governor Wallace, with the two students who were going to go to the university, and most of all with Bobby Kennedy at the Justice Department and a crew that will go with Bobby Kennedy when he goes to the White House. So there is film. This whole thing, in a sense, this crisis, these 2 days, and actually before, because the Kennedys are strategizing for at least 2 or 3 weeks before the events of June the 11th in Tuscaloosa at the University of Alabama, the cameras are rolling. So what is there, Joe, is documentary film footage that was made, shot in the White House, shot in the Justice Department, as the Kennedys are handling George Wallace. How they do it, their consultations, the tension in the White House. There was a film made in 1963 called Crisis Behind a Presidential Commitment. You can see it on YouTube or on the JFK Library website. But that was only 52 minutes. The truth is there were hours and hours of film, and I discovered this about 3 years ago, called Robert Drew, asked him how much film there was. He said, well, I think they're 26 hours. They're actually probably many, many times more than that. And I said, where is it? He said, it's the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts and Sciences in Los Angeles and Hollywood. I said, can I see it? He said, yes, if you negotiate with the Academy, which I did. I went out there. I spent several days there looking at the film. It is, Joe, like descending into another time. If you're reconstructing, as this book does, 48 hours in the life of a president, hour by hour, it doesn't get any better than when you're sitting in a screening room, darkened, the archivist comes in with reels and reels of 16-millimeter film, and suddenly, and by the way, which he hasn't seen because the collection was given to the Academy some time ago but remains largely uncatalogued, and there you are watching the president, the attorney general's deputies, Governor Wallace, the two students, all shot by different camera crews, all revealing this extraordinary story unfolding that morning, particularly on June the 11th, which some historians call the most important day in the history of the civil rights movement, because that night, after the governor is faced down, Kennedy will go on television, he will introduce the idea of morality, he will say that civil rights is no longer a legal question, it's a moral one, he will introduce the Civil Rights Act that day.
You're sitting in this console, a period console, really. You have an archivist, and you're watching this film. Some of the footage doesn't have any sound. Some of it has sound, but no images. So you really do, I would assume, there's a fly-on-the-wall feeling to it.
Absolutely. It's, it's extraordinary if you follow someone. How does one reconstruct 48 hours? Well, fortunately, John F. Kennedy lived in the time of television, radio, recording devices. You couldn't do this in the 18th century with Abraham Lincoln, or the 19th century. So you look at diaries, you look at letters. There are some recordings of conversations, audio recordings of conversations in the White House. You look at the president's diary. What I didn't know was the film. I knew there was a 52-minute documentary, which had aired on American TV a month before the president died. That was the one I referred to, Crisis Behind a Presidential Commitment. But I didn't know about the rest of the material. So, yes, you are a fly on the wall. You're an historical voyeur. You're sitting there, and you know the story, but you don't know it in a granular, atmospheric way. And so the story unspools before you on the film. Now, the film isn't always in order. As you say, Joe, there are sometimes images with sound, sometimes sound with no images. By and large, though, they're there. They're careful because they have to be respectful. They turn off the cameras whenever the president looks at them a certain way, or when Bobby looks at them a certain way. If they, I guess they felt we have to be careful here. If there's something the president says, maybe it ought not to be recorded. The best sessions are, though, in the Justice Department, where Bobby Kennedy, who is a field marshal on these 2 days, Bobby's extraordinary. He is, you know, commonly known then as the assistant president, as the most, the second most powerful man in Washington. On these 2 days, he's coordinating the whole response in Alabama. The big fear the Kennedys have is that it's going to explode, that if the governor does not walk away from the University of Alabama, that in fact there will be a regional rebellion, that if will they have to arrest him? Will they have to charge him with contempt of court? All these things play into their strategy. How do we handle him? So when he says no at 11 a.m. on June the 11th in Tuscaloosa at the schoolhouse door, they have to send in the National Guard. And even then they don't know if Wallace will back away. So handling him is hugely delicate. And, of course, John F. Kennedy is a minority president. He didn't even get 50% of the vote in 1960. He and the base of his support is the South. He knows that when the Kennedys act, and they are increasingly disliked in the South, where white Southerners cannot understand what is happening to their, quote, way of life, the Kennedys are saying we have to do this. There are good political reasons, though, for not doing it, the best of which is the end of the Democratic coalition, which we are seeing to this day. Mary Lou Andrew is one of the senator from Louisiana, who is looking to be reelected, probably will not be, and it'll be one of the last senators, Democratic senators in the South. So there are good reasons not to do this, and it is, in a sense, a courageous, bold act that the president has decided that he has to move, and he has to move publicly, and he has to move, he has to redefine. As he's redefined nuclear arms, he has to redefine race. And so that is what he tries to do in his address. And that afternoon, Joe, you might be interested to know, the speech is pulled together that Kennedy will give at 8 p.m. on June the 11th. It's a Tuesday. He doesn't decide to go on the air till 5:45 in the afternoon. He turns to Ted Sorensen, having faced down the two of them, George Wallace and Alabama, and says, it's time to make that speech tonight on civil rights. And Ted Sorensen, who has worked with Kennedy for 11 years and is his wordsmith, says, well, what speech? There is no speech. So the president will instruct Sorensen to start writing a speech. Sorensen will have less than 2 hours to do so. It will be a feverish Keystone Cops affair in the White House until 8 p.m. when JFK will go on the air without a complete speech, and he will give a knockdown masterpiece of a speech on civil rights. He'll only talk 13 minutes, and he'll do part of it winging it. In other words, he'll have to, he doesn't have a complete speech, but he will make this historic appeal to Americans in which he will talk about the morality of civil rights, no longer the legality, and it will all be done in a very fast and messy way. But once he's on the air, he's the captain of cool and a master of the medium, and he knows exactly what he's doing.
You use the phrase captain of cool, and that's actually what I was going to ask you. These two brothers and working through the crisis, that's one sense you get in the book, that they are very cool under enormous pressure.
It really is something to watch them, Joe. And it has always been said the Kennedys were cool under fire. You know, in a sense, JFK particularly was virtually unflappable. It had a lot to do with being in the war, having saved his crew, having survived that, having won every election he contested, often against great odds, whether it was for the House of Representatives or for the Senate or the presidency. Every time he ran, it was against the odds. Having survived a life of illness, there was very little that bothered him. Bobby was pretty much the same way, although he had an entirely different personal experience. And this day, what is extraordinary, we know the brothers were close. What is interesting is when you follow them hour by hour, you can hear their conversations. They talk to each other at least a dozen times a day. When JFK begins this feverish 48 hours in the early hours of June the 10th. He's flying back from Hawaii on Air Force One. He's given a speech there. And the first call, he may have called Bobby from the plane, but his first call when he gets to the White House, having landed at 8:50 and chopper to the White House of Marine One, and then has less than an hour in the White House before he's going to race up to American University in Northwest Washington to give what will be called the peace speech. His first call is to Bobby. And that day they'll talk a dozen times. His last call that day will be to Bobby. His first call the next day will be to Bobby. So there's this elliptical fraternal conversation between them in which sometimes it's hard to know who's saying what, because you'll hear one end of the conversation and they'll just they'll talk almost when you see them they'll just nod, that's to each other, but when they're on the phone you may get one end of the conversation and not the other, but they don't have to say much, they just seem to know. And Bobby, alone among JFK's advisors on June the 10th and June the 11th, is urging him to go hard on civil rights. He's the one urging JFK to go on the air on June the 11th after they face down Wallace, because a crisis is too important to waste. And so they, Bobby, alone among the advisors, Ted Sorensen, Lawrence O'Brien, Kenny O'Donnell, Burke Marshall, Vice President Johnson, all of them do not want Kennedy to go on the air that evening. They just say, you're not ready, there's not enough time for a speech, the legislation, you should speak when the legislation actually goes up to Congress, not when you announce that it will go to Congress. Bobby says, go on the air, Jack, you have to do it now. Americans expect this kind of moral leadership from you. And the Kennedys always know this is what they should do, and it does allowed JFK to introduce this speech in a very eloquent way and to seize the moment. And the Kennedys always knew how to seize the moment, and they did on June the 11th when he gives that speech.
In looking at the speech itself, and I think obviously we have the benefit of hindsight, so in watching this now and knowing what happened and knowing how it turned out and how foreign policy from that time forward and social policy from that time forward of how it was impacted, how important is that context when looking at that tape now?
Well, I think the context is very important. Remember that in both cases, civil rights and nuclear arms, the world was a far different place in what I call lily white Cold War America. There hadn't been, when JFK attempts to make a deal with Khrushchev and appeal to him in this speech at American University, there had been no agreement between Russia and the United States on anything since the beginning of the Cold War in 1945. America had been through Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower. In October of 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis happens, and the world comes as close to Armageddon as it had before or since. So the context was that in 1963, JFK is looking for an opening. How can I seize this issue and move it ahead? It's the same thing in civil rights. He is considered something of a laggard. The movement has been percolating for about 2 years. It got very violent in the winter and spring of 1963. JFK again asks himself, how can I get ahead? How can I pivot? How can I tilt? And how can I make a contribution on these two seismic issues? And so he's no longer, when it comes to nuclear arms, Joe, he's no longer talking about winning the Cold War. He's talking about ending it. On civil rights, he's no longer talking about responding to it. He's talking about leading it. And so the context in an America which was unused to hearing a president talk in the terms that JFK did, terms which are almost subversive when you hear his language, the peace speech, I should mention, was so sensitive in Washington that JFK asked his circle to write it virtually in secret. It's not entirely a secret, but the State Department, the Defense Department, the CIA, the congressional leadership, all of whom might have something of a role in the writing of a major foreign policy address, are cut out of it entirely. It's written carefully over several weeks by a very small circle. And when it's given, the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State won't see it till hours before. Kennedy's concerned that because he's doing something different, on nuclear arms, that he fears that if word gets out of the appeal he'll make to Khrushchev in what was a very conservative anti-communist country, that in fact it will be sabotaged, that the speech will be sabotaged. So he's careful. Civil rights, what he's saying is also highly, highly unusual, the context being an America which virtually in the South is practicing apartheid. And we all know what that was like. But the South was really a different part of America. And the discrimination, of course, was not just limited to the South. So in both cases, you have a president who wants to be a great president, hasn't been able to do it in his first 2.5 years of what was a very fitful, erratic, uneven presidency, which had its share of defeats, who is trying by the end of his presidency, because it will be over in 5 months, to do something different, to pivot, to look at a way forward in these two great areas and looking at these two great problems and say, I, as a president, can use the bully pulpit, the presidency, which, you know, was a term Teddy Roosevelt had introduced. I can use the presidency to do something different. I can't guarantee that it will change things, but I can make an appeal to Khrushchev, which in this case will lead to the limited nuclear test ban treaty of 1963, which will be Kennedy's greatest foreign policy achievement. He will then, of course, the next night introduce the Civil Rights Bill of 1964. He won't live to see it, but it will become the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, which will become one of the two or three seminal pieces of legislation of the 20th century in the United States. And that will change things. So in both cases, and that will be, of course, his greatest domestic achievement. So these 2 days, what I call JFK's journey to peace and freedom, because that is really what they're all about, is really an extraordinary time for an American president who is seen historically to have been, well, maybe ineffective, maybe all glamour and less substance. If you look at these 2 days, I think you'll find a president who really becomes president, who inhabits the job for the first time, who really believes that he can make a difference and that Americans can make a difference. And although public opinion may not be with them right away, it will be eventually.
The title of the book is 2 Days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. Andrew Cohen is the author. Andrew, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Again, the title of the book, 2 Days in June. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.